This is a recording of Ward Churchill giving A History of Counterintelligence. He spoke at the National Conference for Organized Resistance at American University in Washington, D.C. on January 28, 2001. Ward Churchill is professor of American Indian Studies at the University of Colorado at Boulder. He is a prolific author. Among his many books are Fantasies of the Master Race, Since the Predator Came, and A Little Matter of Genocide. Most recently, AK Press published Churchill's latest book called On the Justice of Roosting Chickens, Reflections on the Consequences of U.S. Imperial Arrogance and Criminality. Most closely related to this recording is the book The COINTELPRO Papers, co-authored by Ward Churchill. Here he presents the history of government surveillance, infiltration, and provocation. This presentation begins with the Pinkerton Detective Agency of the mid-19th century, continues with the government repression of immigrants and radicals during the World War I era, and goes on through the FBI's counterintelligence program of the 1950s, 60s, and 70s. Churchill assesses the damage done to several social movements by a century and a half of disruption. He also describes some of the tactics used by the government to damage activists and social movements. Although this presentation was made nearly a year before the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks in the United States, the history given in the talk provides a valuable background to understanding the U.S. government's actions in the terror war. A lot of what we are seeing today has vivid historical precedents. Ward Churchill was introduced by one of the conference organizers.
So this workshop is going to be hosted by Ward Churchill. He's played a significant role in exposing the counterintelligence programs of the FBI, a.k.a. COINTELPRO, of 1956 to 71. And he co-wrote the COINTELPRO papers. Currently, he's a professor in the Ethnic Studies Department at the University of Colorado in Boulder. He's published extensively on indigenous rights issues, political repression, and the politics of imprisonment. This workshop is part one of two. The second is going to be addressing the counterintelligence issues of today. It's on your schedule. It's called Balancing Fears and Realities, Paranoia and Precaution for Our Movement Today. It should be really good as well, so hope you all stick around for that one. And here's Ward.
CO, Osiju, hello, my relatives. Good to see you here. I'm not going to repeat everything that was said to begin yesterday, but I'm going to take the same approach that was taken in the pacifism pathology workshop. I'm not sure how talking heads fit into workshops, but that seems to be the format, and so we'll proceed with it. What I'm going to try to do is give an overview of the subject matter, the way Vanderwall and I presented it, Donner and Goldstein and a few other people have presented it, just to set some parameters on it. Convert as much time as possible into interaction and interchange, because there's going to be big holes. There's way, way too much detail that's involved in this. The FBI has been very busy, okay? So there's no way we're going to get to all of it in the presentation part. If I even attempted to, that would take up all of the time. So we won't do that. But I'm going to try to lay out the history, some of the techniques, some of the commonalities that run through thing. Chip Burleigh will be taking it up to current in the next workshop, as is already mentioned. I encourage everyone to go to that because it's more like current events. But current events can only be understood in terms of their historical legs. This stuff is not new. And there's ways that it needs to be looked at in order to counter it effective. Counterintelligence, perhaps. But to begin with, I suppose, was a statement that was made yesterday, is that infiltration of organizations is some kind of an all-time high, so let's just tag it right there and back up. No, it's not. No, it's not. There was a point coming into the 1960s when the Socialist Workers' Party was composed one-third of FBI personnel. We used to have a joke during the 60s about you could always tell who the FBI agents were in the Communist Party by the fact that they were paying dues. Had they not, the organization would have been totally defunct. It was 50% and upwards of the total CP membership were either active agent personnel or people who had been retained one way or another to provide information to the FBI. We're talking a third of a century ago, but let's back it up to where this actually all begins, and you have to have an inception date, that's the way the Bureau would refer to it, of about 1852 with the foundation of the Pinkerton Detective Agency, because that's the precursor to the FBI. Ronald Reagan didn't invent privatization. The idea at the time of the Civil War in the United States, when they didn't even have a Justice Department yet, they were in process of forming that, was that they would farm out the investigative activity of the federal government to the private sector, that there were people with the competencies and the expertise out there that could be a cost-cutting or a savings measure for the central government if they did not have to establish their own. The Pinkertons, as you probably know, and if you don't, I'm about to inform you, its bread and butter was working for major corporate interests in the society, primarily the railroads and the steel corporations, not exclusively so, but that's where their bread and butter was. And so from the very inception of this whole thing, you've got this unholy interlock between private sector police accountable to no one other than their paymasters, corporate interests in the federal government. That triangle has existed since the moment this stuff began. And the operational techniques and the priorities that accrue from that have been present since before the FBI as such, even before the Bureau of Investigation, which is the federal precursor of the FBI, ever came into existence. You got a half century of operational reality here. And on the one hand, the Pinkertons are best known for mounting private armies that work for the corporations to suppress strikers and so forth. But on the other hand, they had an active counterintelligence profile that was in some ways more effective than the mounting of the armies themselves. And let me give you a couple of examples of how this stuff is formed by the Pinkertons and then carried on into politically repressive activities in the second half of the 20th century. The way the Pinkertons get on the board, for example, is to conjure up the idea that there is a secessionist plot to assassinate Abraham Lincoln before he even takes office. He's on a train coming over for the inauguration. Alan Pinkerton, who is the founder of the Pinkerton Detective Agency, goes to the federal government and says, I've uncovered this secessionist plot. A bunch of Southerners, pro-slavery people, who are going to assassinate the president-elect. And they said, well, what do we do about it? And he says, I can handle it. And Lincoln was not assassinated, and therefore it was a successful operation. There is no evidence at all that such a plot existed. Thing one was done by the Pinkerton Detective Agency to avert an assassination. They simply announced it as a fact based on confidential sources that no one could know about, because if you reveal the nature of the sources, you would render them inoperative. Then the event that was predicted didn't happen, and that's attributed as being a success. So you can conjure up these criminal conspiracies of political activists. What will be received in the body politic is a criminal conspiracy, and you can prevent it from functioning, or so you say, take credit for it, and further your interest in your luster and your reputation, and in this case, become the primary investigative entity for the federal government itself. Now let me tie that to something in the 20th century. Daniel and Philip Berrigan, terrorist Catholic clergy, okay, were dragged into court in the late 1960s, early 70s actually, I think it was 71, on a plot to assassinate Henry Kissinger by blowing up the tunnels in Washington, D.C. with aerosol spray cans. All right? This is Looney Tunes. It's laughable, except these guys were facing 40 years on criminal conspiracy charges for taking out government officials, to wit Kissinger. There is no evidence at all that the FBI has ever produced that this was even discussed. It was simply a group of infiltrator provocateurs working for the FBI who reported this to be a fact. No corroborating information at all. And you got a, number one, sensationalist press campaign that could be mounted off the back of this in order to convince the general public of the United States that there is a terrorist conspiracy that warrants extraordinarily draconian responses by the federal government in the name of public order, okay, and an accomplishment for the Bureau that it can hang its hat on, that it can increase its public luster on, that it's invented out of whole cloth. Pinkerton technique in 1861, FBI technique 1971, 110 years difference, exactly the same thing, except they're more effective at it in 1971, of course, because you got a more effective media apparatus out there, and the technique has been refined to a considerable extent. That's how they come on the boards. Anybody out there ever heard of the James Younger gang in Missouri? Anybody seen the Long Riders? You heard of Jesse James? That was a Pinkerton operation in behalf of the railroads and the government of the state of Missouri, and ultimately for the United States government, because the laying of track rail lines is part of the industrial infrastructure of the United States. There's actually an official program of the U.S. to further the interests of the robber barons who are building the railroads, because it furthers the interests of the United States, not only in economic terms, but in strategic terms, to have rapid transit, all right? Now, they had a rough time with the James boys, and Youngers, too, for that matter, partly because the citizenry of southern Missouri wasn't really fond of having these fat cats come in and impound their land, dispossess them, push them off their property in order to lay railroad tracks through the area for some abstract notion of the greater good, whose interests really coincided with the people who were doing it to them, and they understood that much better than the average Americans did. And so when the James boys responded by robbing trains, they weren't the first. There's a whole another operation we could talk about in Indiana with the Reno gang and how the Pinkertons took care of them. But let's stick with this one, because there's some continuity into the 20th century with it. The upshot of that is that those guys were pretty popular in southern Missouri. And the upshot of that upshot was that the Pinkertons were spectacularly unsuccessful in being able to apprehend the James Younger group. So how did they resolve the problem? What was this success, the method that was used to accomplish the neutralization, as they would later call it, of the James gang? They hired an infiltrator to go in and blow the back of Jesse James' head off in his own parlor. Case closed. So what you've got, if it was in an overtly political context, is an assassination that just occurred. And they still celebrate in that one. Okay? Let's pull this up to the 4th of December, 1969. Fred Hampton, narcotized, asleep, unconscious in his apartment, a raider team coordinated by the FBI, but composed of special squad of state's attorney's police in Chicago, Illinois, comes into Hampton's apartment with a map prepared for them, floor plan, actually, floor plan that's prepared for them by an FBI infiltrator by the name of William O'Neill, with an X marked on the location of Hampton's bed so that one of the guys could stand in the next room and fire a Thompson submachine gun the full length of the wall into Hampton's bed to neutralize a Black Panther Party leader of extraordinary importance in the assessment of the FBI and coincidentally in the assessment of everybody else as well. Why did they assassinate Fred Hampton? Because they tried to take him out by other means and they had not been successful in doing so. They'd attempted to discredit him, they'd attempted to put him in prison, they'd attempted several things to take him out of action. Hadn't worked, so they killed him. Exactly the same thing in principle as it was done by the Pinkertons in terms of solving, put quotes around that, the James Younger case. Jesse James was the last of the leadership of that gang, as they called it, as they call us from time to time, okay, to take them out of action to be able to close the books on it. Pennsylvania coal fields, about the same time as Jesse James, you got an organization composed of immigrant, Irish workers known as the Molly Maguires. Pinkerton solved this as well. How do they do it? They send in a guy whose name is actually McPherson, but goes by the name of McFarland, to impersonate an expatriate Irish liberationist who's been driven out of Ireland by the British version of the Pinkerton agency and has taken refugee status among his exiled countrymen in the coal fields to infiltrate the Molly Maguires. Does so quite successfully up to the position or the circle of the leadership, Black Jack Kehoe and so forth. Okay, begins to propose things that the Mollies weren't doing. Response in kind, dynamite activities, blowing up mine shafts and ventilator systems, assassinations of foremen and so forth. Some of this was acted upon, some of it was not, but ultimately he is persuasive enough and able to somehow mysteriously acquire the ordinance necessary to carry out these activities so that there's a major action planned. And guess what? Just as they show up to set the dynamite charges at the mine shaft, Pinkerton's police, mine police, private personnel, all manner of so-called law enforcement personnel are sitting there waiting in ambush. And you end up with 38 members, if I remember right, of the leadership of the Molly Maguires going to the gallows. The mine owner was the judge in the court. Okay? But the point here is you got a provocateur, not just an infiltrator. An infiltrator will go in and feed back information, sensitive information, critical intelligence information. A provocateur will go in to disrupt, mislead, or do things in an active fashion to destroy the organization from the inside. And this is a classic sort of provocateur entrapment scenario that has worked out in the 1880s. Okay, let's carry that up into the 20th century. Late 1960s in New England, you got a guy by the name of Tommy Tagne, who was driving around in a recycled bread truck painted with flower power, boom power to the Weather Nation and all that. He's a hyper-militant individual who goes from campus to campus trying to convince the local SDS chapters to bomb the ROTC buildings there. I'm not going to pass judgment one way or another on whether it's an effective tactic to bomb the ROTC buildings, but the point of the matter is that this guy is working both for the criminal intelligence divisions of the state investigative agencies in each of the New England states and the FBI. And every time you've got an attempt to bomb an ROTC building, the leadership cadre of the local SDS chapter ends up facing criminal conspiracy charges. So the techniques are worked out in the 19th century in terms of counterintelligence. What is counterintelligence actually? Well, counterintelligence has nothing at all to do with law enforcement. It has to do with, according to one of the people who puts COINTELPRO, and we'll come to that, one of the architects of COINTELPRO puts it this way. It has nothing to do with acquiring intelligence information for purposes of bringing charges and prosecutions and penalties. It has to do with neutralizing target. If you effect a neutralization of the target, it means the target can no longer do whatever it was that caused the targeting to occur in the first place, and you have a successful operation. Counterintelligence normally applies in the venue, and by charter applies for the FBI in the venue of the agents or representatives of hostile foreign powers. Now, you can include friendly foreign powers in there as well, but it has to do with things like espionage, sabotage, and so forth. You take out foreign nationals who are acting inside the borders of the United States in a clandestine fashion against the interests of the United States by bombing factories or sending disinformation or whatever, you eliminate their capacity to do that. It's not within a legal framework. Constitutional rights and guarantees do not apply. Those are totally suspended. These are people who are acting under the Espionage Act and under international law in a capacity that means that they can be summarily executed if apprehended in the process. That's the framework of understanding in which counterintelligence operations occur. That's something by legal definition, which is not applicable to the citizenry of the United States in pursuit of their political ideals, visions, or whatever. It's not really until, as was indicated in the introduction, 1956, that there is a formal inception of a counterintelligence program nationwide basis by the FBI, which is directed at the citizenry of the United States. But the precursors that we're talking about figure into the Bureau of Investigation and the FBI as a continuation of what the Pinkerton Agency has been doing right from day one. And day one really becomes 1912. It's 1912 is when they, for the first time, create an investigative entity within the Justice Department itself. Well, sort of. It is a Justice Department operation, but now who's going to be qualified to staff it? And the answer to that, obviously, is Pinkerton personnel. So they simply change the designator on their paychecks from being this supposedly private sector entity, the Pinkertons, to being the government of the United States itself. But the linkages couldn't be more clear. It's exactly the same people. They just come onto the government payroll. And you start to see other patterns that are continued throughout the 20th century at that point. selective prosecution, things which are technically an abridgment of federal law, because that's what it is they're mandated to do, to investigate suspected abridgments, violations of federal law. And there's a long list of things. They got about 9 people staffing-wise at the outset, but they got this list that goes on for pages of laws and violations thereof that they're supposed to investigate. And in a way, I suppose you could say, practically speaking, there was no possibility that they could get to all of it, so they have to be selective in some sense. But the nature of the selectivity is very instructive. You have something, the Mann Act, for example, otherwise known as the White Slave Act, which is a federal law that was written in order to curtail interstate organization of prostitution. The way the law reads is that anyone who, a knowing consort, takes an unmarried female below the age of 21 across state lines can be charged under provision of the Mann Act. That's revised ultimately to read any female to whom you're not married. If you're a male, you take across, transport across state lines, you're subject to prosecution. Now, by and large, there are no prosecutions under the Mann Act. This is geared towards Diamond Jim Colosimo and the people in the Levee District of Chicago in particular, but also areas in New York City and New Orleans and so on. No prosecutions, no investigations that you can find records of are occurring with regards to organized prostitution. What they do, the first and most notorious case of application of the Mann Act is against a guy by the name of Jack Johnson. Anybody know who that is? Yeah, world heavyweight champion boxer who happens to be black, which is absolutely, at this point in the evolution of American enlightenment, a no-no. See, white guys are not just intellectually superior in the early part of the 20th century, in the early 1900s. They're superior in every way, which includes physically. Now, they've gotten over that, okay? But at the time, a black man is not supposed to be able to beat up the world champion white boxer. And Johnson not only did, but he made a joke of it. And then he asked him to bring in 2 and 3 at a time, and he made a joke of that as well. They couldn't beat him up in the ring. So they charged him with traveling to Wisconsin from Chicago with his fiancée, who, horror of horrors, was a white woman, and ran him out of the country, destroyed his title, and so forth. All right, technically there was a violation, but a selective prosecution for an obviously political interest, and it's to do what it is that the FBI as a totality is designed to do. The best case you can put on all of this, that the FBI really has nothing to do with the law part of law enforcement. It has everything to do with the enforcement, and what it is that it's intended to enforce is the order of things as they're encountered. There is a place for everyone. There is a place for everything in this social hierarchy, and their job is to make sure that everyone and everything stays in that place so the system functions as it's intended to function by the people who design it and benefit most from it. That's their job. So the liberal critique that the FBI gets derailed, loses its sense of focus when it does these kinds of things, that it engages in excesses and so forth, that you need guidelines to curtail its activities within certain parameters, misses the point entirely. And the point is that it's designed to do exactly what it does. Exactly how it goes about doing it is, to some extent, irrelevant. It's the mission of the institution itself, which we have to understand and oppose. But let's go back to how they've gone about it, and the implications of how they've gone about it. You really see the surge in the FBI, which is still at that time known as the BOI, along about the time of World War I. And you got 3 major things which will resonate in the consciousness of stuff that happens in the 60s and 70s and the 80s that occur during World War I. They pass the Espionage Act, they pass an Alien Act. Under wartime conditions, need to tighten up, get everybody a little more disciplined. We're actually at war. We're getting ready to go at war. Whatever. And they say it's the hostile powers. Well, if you're neutral, you got no particular group of hostile nations out there, but the hostile powers are supposed to be Germany, Austria-Hungary, and so forth. The United States is aligned, even though it's ostensibly neutral with Great Britain. So they're saying they need to have the Espionage Act to combat German saboteurs and so forth. You actually have one incident, whether it was created by German saboteurs or not, I don't know. It's a little ambiguous. But you got the Black Tom Island explosion. That serves as a predication. Now, it's interesting here. There's this juxtaposition between the Espionage Act and the Alien Act. Basically, what they're saying is that anybody who would engage in espionage must be an alien, but the aliens they're concerned about don't happen, for the most part, to be Germans. They happen to be Southern Europeans, and they're Southern Europeans that they're concerned with, well, partly because they're not quite white. All right, you got this influx of bad blood coming in the country, and there's a whole furor going on about that. But worse, they have these foreign ideologies and ideals, primarily anarchism. So the first thing they do, and it's kind of a test run, is something called the slacker raids. Now, this is instructive as well. They take people who are resisting universal conscription, the draft, in other words, and make them the primary target. Then they create this vigilante organization called the American Protective League, because you still don't have a whole lot of agents. So they need some horsepower. So they form this mass organization of American patriots, who incidentally mostly are of draft age, and then send them around in cities under FBI or Bureau of Investigation coordination from location to location, say saloon to pool hall to boarding house, to find males who are of draft age who do not have a selective service card. They ought to be in the Army. They at least got to be signed up for the draft. See, these guys who are self-evidently dodging the draft themselves, but from the right point of view, in service to the country, take people who might have the wrong ideas about why they wouldn't go into the military and fight in the trenches in France, and round them up and impose the compulsory conscription. Now, this is a vigilante organization, a right-wing organization of the first magnitude, becomes the amplitude of the FBI. That's its reach. That's its manpower. That's its horsepower. Coordinated. Private sector organization, but functioning in a de facto official capacity. It's like they've all been deputized, but there's no authorization to make such a deputization. Now, that's the warm-up. They do this on a nationwide basis. The contradictions are brought up in the press, but they're quelled quite easily. It's one thing to be a patriotic draft dodger like Dan Quayle. It's another thing to be a patriotic draft or an unpatriotic draft dodger, which means someone who's avoiding military service on principle. Principles are what's at issue. And they make that very clear, because the next round is something called the Palmer Raids. And the Palmer Raids are directed not at the saloons and pool halls, but at the immigrant halls, foreign language newspapers, boarding houses that cater to people that just came off the boat, and they round up 5,000 of them in a 50-city nationwide sweep in one night in early 1920. And then they sift them out. Now, you got things that sound like Chile after the overthrow of Allende that are occurring here. They got these people cooped up in basketball gymnasiums, no running water, one toilet for 500 people, old people, men, women, children alike, they're all foreigners. And you got these Bureau of Investigation agents who are sitting there screening them. What are they screening them for? They're screening them by name, okay? It's been compiled by a little clerk by the name of John Edgar Hoover, who's been hired to create a subversives list. And what they're screening on, how they arrived at whose names they wanted to detain, they'll cut the other people loose, is did they subscribe to an anarchist newspaper? Did they have relatives in the old country who were members of the anarchist movement? Was there somebody involved in socialist politics? Had somebody voted for Eugene Debs? All right. So they winnow that down ultimately to 500 people who were the key anarchists in this foreign constituency that they've identified on file work in Washington, D.C., and they put them all on a boat, USS Buford, in New York Harbor, and they send them to Russia. They're not from Russia, mind you. These guys are Italians and Bulgarians, and okay, but they send them to Russia. Why Russia? Because you've had the Bolshevik Revolution. They're all Reds, they're left-leaning, so what better place? Why send them back to Italy? Mess up Italy, yeah. So that's how Emma Goldman ends up living in Moscow. All right? Emma Goldman's not Russian. Right? She never spent. She didn't speak Russian. She didn't even like Lenin, right? They sent her there anyway. Okay, next round after that is the IWW. This is the largest anarcho-syndicalist entity in the history of the United States. The one big union, the idea of the general strike, something that actually threatened the stability of the status quo. The idea was catching on. There's more than 1 million people went through the IWW during the course of its existence. It had the capacity to actually affect a transformation in industrial relations in this country, and it had a very strong rhetoric. I emphasize rhetoric. It defined things in terms of class warfare. And that rhetoric was turned around through the able administration of government propaganda to suggest that this was a violent organization. You look at the actual history of the American labor movement, you find something very interesting. Of all the major labor organizations at the turn of the century, the least violent of them all was the IWW. They worked on mass power. They didn't work on sabotage. They didn't work on assassinations and so forth. But they articulated a very radical view of how the relationships in the United States would have to be rearranged if there was to be social justice and economic justice and things like that. On the other hand, you got liberal organizations like the AFL and the CIO, who didn't call for a radical transformation of relations, something more along the lines of simple equity, and they punctuated it with all kinds of labor violence. But they ultimately get sanctioned by the federal government as the representatives of the labor movement, the IWW, who had the idea of something far more constructive and progressive, was utterly obliterated. Ultimately, with the largest mass trial in the history of the United States, 101 IWW leaders in one courtroom in Chicago, Illinois, charged on sedition and so forth. They had a set of bleachers in a courtroom to hold the defendants, and they were all convicted. So you got a decapitation, two-pronged, the roundup and summary deportation of the so-called foreign anarchist leadership, and the obliteration of the actual anarcho-syndicalist organization that happened in about a two-year period of time. Now, you've got to stop for a second and ask yourself, what would the contours of the American labor movement, what would the consciousness of the American working class be in 2001 if in 1921 they hadn't totally destroyed a very viable, vibrant, and growing anarchist labor movement on the basis of what amounts to counterintelligence intervention? Okay, you got the repressive statutes, but you've also got the people who weren't roped into these mass trials. And the Chicago trial was simply the largest. It wasn't the only one. You had one in Sacramento of 40 people. You had one in Kansas of 36 people, and so on. The elimination of the leadership structure in toto. But key organizers in the field were simply being assassinated. Frank Little, for example, was made an example of by Pinkerton agents working in collaboration with a local Bureau of Investigation office in Montana, and was essentially lynched. No, there's nothing essentially about it. He was lynched, period, and left hanging on a railroad trestle as a warning to other radical organizers to get the hell out of the mining fields of Montana. And this was a throwback to the Reno operation that I didn't talk about in the 19th century. And finally, you got one other that I want to make from early 20th century as an example, a guy by the name of Marcus Garvey. Garvey, head of the United Negro Improvement Association, which to this day remains the largest mass movement, mass organization of African Americans in the history of the United States, who had a certain set of politics early in his life, but at the time he gets UNIA on the board, really would have been probably someone that the more conscious Republicans over in the Bush White House would have coveted as a leader for the black community now, because it was black self-sufficiency. Kind of a precursor to Farrakhan's rap. Business starts, community organizing, self-help, stuff like that. Blacks weren't supposed to self-help in those days. They were supposed to be utterly dependent, as in large part they remain today. But he was targeted on that basis. You got to be dependent. You got to be a surplus labor force to keep the cost of labor down among white workers who were the preferred workers. We need to take you out. How did they take him out? On a stock fraud thing. He was trying to start something called a Black Star Steamship Line. Put out an advertisement for investors. People invested Black Star at the particular moment. If I remember the specifics of the case correctly, Black Star at that moment did not need a infusion of capital, but they had other businesses in the constellation of things that UNIA was trying to get going that did need capital. No one ever accused Garvey of profiting from it. He simply put the investments for Black Star Line into another business and went to prison, maximum security in Atlanta, on a 10-year sentence. Ultimately was deported. They let him out of prison on a quid pro quo. He'd never come back to the United States. UNIA collapses. But now there's something very interesting in this. You got an active investigation of Marcus Garvey that's undertaken in 1918. The conviction does not occur until 1924. The guy in charge of the investigation in 1918 is his file clerk by the name of John Edgar Hoover. And he writes this little letter at the end of his intensive field investigation of Marcus Garvey. He said, "We have done the investigation. We have scrutinized Garvey's activities extraordinarily closely, and, quote, unfortunately, end quote, we can find no violations of federal law. And therefore, I recommend the investigation continue. If we look at him long enough, we will find something. I'm confident." And ultimately, they do on this pretext. Now, this is a technical violation of law as well. Stock fraud, manipulation of the stock market. Can we think of another contemporaneous example of somebody manipulating the stock market? How about President of the United States, this revered, figure in American history, John F. Kennedy, his daddy, Joe, who took money off bootlegging with Dutch Schultz and gambling operations with Arnold Rothstein, funneled him into the stock market, had himself positioned so he could manipulate things in such a way that he had actual tangible impact in the stock market collapse of 1929. His punishment was to be drawn into the Treasury Department to write a set of laws to prevent anyone from doing what it was he'd just done. They let him keep the money, incidentally, which is how the Kennedys got rich. And he did that so well, outlawing his own activities, that they made him the first Irish ambassador to the court of St. James, just a little different than the experience of Marcus Garvey on the cheap, don't you think? I mean, there's about $10,000 involved in the Garvey case, none of it pocketed. There's about $30 million in personal profit involved in the Kennedy case, and you can see the difference in outcomes. So I do not need to hear arguments of a technical nature as to, well, you did break the law. Coming from an entity which violates its own constitutional requirement for equal justice before the law and is at odds with every single element of international law which is supposedly binding on its comportment, I don't need to hear about buckle your seatbelt. It's the law. Now, what would the face of the African-American community at the dawn of a new century look like if UNIA had not been neutralized as a matter of political expedience under the pretext of law by counterintelligence specialists of the Bureau of Investigation as a very, very high national priority? Labor movement, anarchist movement, black movement, these are major counters. And they're eliminating possibility every time this happens. People conceive of a viable alternative to their assigned place in the order of things, and they set about creating that reality, and they're moving on it, and it's a very constructive and hopeful sign, and then it's shattered, and penalties are visited. There's a message. There's a message there to the people who are involved in those things, and there's a message to their children. They're sending a message. They're sending a message. That's a term that they put out in the 1980s quite a lot. We're doing particular things we're doing not because they're necessary to do in their own right. We're overreacting, perhaps, but what we're trying to do is send a message to others by making examples. And they're making examples of constructive things in order to maintain an extraordinarily repressive, regressive social order, the order that we all oppose. Well, the 1956 INSEP of COINTELPRO, it's a maintenance instrument, basically. We can talk about a whole proliferation of comparable antecedent arguments. But 56 is an interesting date when they start this up. It's on the tail end of the period that's somewhat erroneously known as McCarthyism. And basically what you've got at that point is an absolute obliteration of everything to the left of Attila the Hun and the entire social fabric of the United States. Okay? Would have made Frank Rizzo up in Philadelphia really, really proud. But the entire discourse, and 30 years later, you still see the ramifications of what they did to the conceptual understandings, the possibility of conceiving alternatives in the United States. And what it is that happens 30, actually 20 years later, is they start a little program on CNN. Some of you may have seen it. It's called Crossfire. That's where the left and the right engage one another. Yeah, it's a joke now, but you should have seen it in the beginning. They had on the right Bob Novak. Okay, this is truth in advertising. This is truly way right. I mean, Heinrich Himmler would be embarrassed with some of this stuff. Yeah, the right is ably represented here, and on the left you have Tom Brady, whose main pedigree is having been CIA station chief in Italy in the immediate post-World War II environment to subvert the Italian elections to prevent the Italian communists from gaining seats by the electoral process. That's the left. And so you got something that would be fascistically right-wing as the left, and then you got something way, way to the right of that. And that's the political discourse in the United States. And you wonder how people get so screwed up in their perceptions of things, they actually peddling this as being a left-right debate. This didn't happen by accident. In the context of the U.S. political discourse at the time, that actually is a left-right juxtaposition. This country is so far to the right that it really would make the Third Reich kind of shudder. They hadn't conceived these politics. This has not got to do with the racial content. It's got to do with the politics themselves. You had Nazis further to the left than the average American political pundit, and that's a fact. Go check it out. Check the Strasser brothers and so forth. I'm not trying to redeem these guys. I'm just trying to point it out for purposes of comparison. And this did not happen because there's something congenital in the American body politic which drives people into right-wing postures from birth. It takes some engineering. We're talking about the process of engineering. This is the goal of this stuff. So what did they do with COINTELPRO? They set up a process by which they could maintain that repression of political consciousness on a permanent level without having to do public dog and pony shows like the show trials of the 1940s and 50s. And they used as a laboratory, if you will, something called the Communist Party to do it. Now, the Communist Party had been the main target of the McCarthyites, and they were doing it right out front in public and purging anyone from any position of influence in American life because not of membership or participation in the Communist Party, but any kind of association at all, even three and four steps removed. It was that deep a cut in the political involvement of Americans, the realm of permissibility that had been made. But you can't maintain that public profile forever, so they decided to maintain it that way in secret. They used the CP, which was moribund. It no longer really existed. It had been destroyed. They revived it. That was the bit about the jokes. They began to infiltrate FBI personnel in phenomenal numbers into the Communist Party, taking with them cash resources to create the appearance that there was an entity so that they could practice techniques of destroying and maintaining and subverting it. Infiltrate, take over the leadership, mislead it, badjacking. The bona fide cadres. You understand about badjacking? This is one of the most insidious techniques there is. It comes out of prisons. But they apply it in a broader social circumstance here. That's where they will infiltrate people, establish their credibility, and they use the credibility they've established as infiltrators, agents provocateurs, to discredit the legitimate activists within the organization. Is targeted, usually by making a case that they are the infiltrators and the cops. So you end up with all these scenarios where people are sitting there cop-baiting one another to the point of paranoia and self-neutralization, and that's actually something they come out with in the late 1960s with the SDS, with the Students for a Democratic Society, said the purpose of the operation was to convince the genuine activists that there was an agent behind every mailbox and in their bedroom with them. Two different memos juxtaposed create this paranoid condition, which would be in itself sufficient in many cases to prevent people from engaging in actual constructive political activity. They would be so absolutely unable to make a determination of who they could trust to work with. So it goes by cop baiting, it goes by rumor mongering, it goes by internal dissemination of disinformation.